Hello and welcome to this episode of the Postural Restoration Podcast. Today is really a unique opportunity and kind of the first time within this podcast series that we're really going to have a little bit of a hybrid episode here. My guest today is Jennifer Smart, and Jennifer, we'll get into some of your history and background and your degrees as a physical therapist and your current practice. But again, for our listeners, I'm personally so excited to have you on today. And I know we're going to pull Ron in later to kind of walk through a little bit of your involvement and preparation for this year's spring symposium, which we'll get into towards the latter half of this episode. Again, for our listeners, this is meant to kind of provide more awareness to your discussions for that symposium, but also get to know you and a little bit of your background and history before we get into, you know, your involvement with this year's annual interdisciplinary integration symposium. So welcome, Jennifer, and I really appreciate you taking the time today to sit down and help us provide our listeners with more information about you and everything you're working on.
Well, thank you. I'm excited to do this.
And Jennifer, I will, we'll start kind of here at the top and get to know you a little bit better. For everyone listening, I think you're in Oriental, North Carolina, and I don't know how long you've resided there, but we'll get to that as well and kind of how you ended up there and your history. But walk our listeners through a little bit, Jennifer, about, you know, just starting with your schooling and how you became interested in the field in general. I know you initially received a bachelor's of physical therapy as part of your really first physical therapy degree, and we won't go back into the years that was. You're a seasoned clinician, but just walk us through, you know, at what point in your life and maybe even some of the influences you had or mentors along the way that really got you interested in the field of physical therapy.
As with most things in my life, I stumbled into it. It's true. I mean, I have always just been one of those people that kind of falls into things. My first degree was actually in economics, and I was in the graduate program of economics, and the boyfriend I had at the time was in med school, and I was the one who was holding his flashcards and doing the, you know, anatomy and physiology flashcards with him, and I kept thinking, I know these, I was more excited about learning about it than he was. And he's like, why are you in economics? And I was like, I don't want to be a doctor. And he's like, well, you know, why don't you try physical therapy? So I literally went over to the physical therapy department and found out that I was pretty interested in it. So I asked if I could, you know, sit in on a few classes. And the next thing I know is I got the, you know, I went into physical therapy. So I already had my economics degree, went back and got my bachelor's in physical therapy. And then right after that, I ended up moving to England. I'm a little embarrassed to say it, but I picked up a hitchhiker, which was okay back in those days. And he was an Englishman. And I ended up finding out that he was heading back to England. And I was really interested in him and in what he was doing in England. And so I ended up moving to England. And when I got over there, they didn't recognize my University of Maryland degree. And they didn't recognize my physical therapy license. So they made me do something called basic grade for 2 years, where I had to go through 6 clinical rotations, 3 months each. I had to do peds, neuro, ortho, wound care, and chest PT. They didn't have respiratory therapists at that point, chest PT and geriatrics. So at first I was very indignant. I was like, you know, come on, I've got my degree. But with hindsight, that was the absolute best thing that ever happened to me, because it exposed me to so much more. And what I learned is that I didn't learn that much in school. It's the patients that I saw at each one of those rotations that taught me the most. And when you talk about mentors, it's all patients. When I think about mentors, all of them are patients. They've taught me what I know. So what I found when I got to England, I thought I was going to be interested in ortho. So my first rotation was with a very, very well-regarded foot and ankle person. And they had me doing some research. And I was doing a very simple research. It was looking at how over-the-counter orthotics could influence pronation and supination. And basically, we were just taking measurements of the calcaneus. And what I noticed is that consistently, the right foot was more supinated than the left. And I started asking questions about that, but that nobody was interested in that. And so that I kind of filed away. And then my very next rotation was neuro. And at that time, Bobath was very popular. And so I was learning a lot of the Bobath patterns and or the Bobath material. And what I noticed was with the strokes that the hemiplegic had the same patterns, that if you had a left CVA, you rotated to the right. And those people really rotated to the right. They would roll their foot over into supination a lot more. Whereas if they had a right CVA, they didn't rotate to the left as much. And so it was interesting building on what I had just done in ortho to the neuro. And so all of these things started building up. And then I went into the respiratory and I realized how important the breathing was. So all of those things I was forced to see, you know, when I went over there. So that turned out to be a wonderful experience with hindsight. And then while I was over there, I lived there for, I guess, 2 or 3 years. I ended up getting a small sailboat, a 24-foot wooden sailboat. And it was built in 1947. And I thought it was a beautiful little boat, but everybody kept looking at this stout little boat and telling me, oh, she was meant to go across oceans. And I got it in my mind that I would take her across one and I would bring her back to the United States. And so I ended up sailing from England. I went down, it's the Milk Run. If you choose at the right time, it sounds exciting, but it's basically the prevailing winds. Just any idiot could get in a boat and do it. I'm going to be honest. It's pretty predictable. You go France, Spain, Portugal, down the north corner of Africa, and then across to the Canary Islands and over to the Caribbean. But I did that. And when I was out on that little boat, what really was interesting is that on land, I was fixed and I had to reach for everything and bring everything to me is what I am on the boat. You never, ever let go of your hand. You know, you always had a hand for the boat. That's the expression, you know, one hand for what you're doing, one hand for the boat. And what I learned there is all of those origins and insertions that I had learned and had been working with concentrically suddenly switched on the boat. And I was thinking everything in reverse. So I would hang on to the rail and my body would move away. That's the only way I wasn't going to get hurt on this little boat. And it made me look at things in a slightly different way. And that I didn't realize at the time how important that was. But that actually has played a big part in how I treated patients afterwards. So, and then the only other thing I'm going to say about the boat trip was, and I've talked to Ron quite a few bit about this, is that navigating, this was, like you're saying, it was a long time ago. GPS was not even a thing yet. So I had a sextant, which I don't know if you know anything about sextants. All they are is measure angles. They measure the angle from the ground, the horizon to the celestial body you're looking at, the sun, the moon, or the stars. And the only way those things make any sense whatsoever is if you have a really accurate timepiece. You got to know exactly where you are at what time to mean anything, because that sun is only there at that particular angle above the earth at that specific time of the day. So if you had an accurate timepiece, you could navigate with just a simple little thing that measured angles. And that's how I did it. So I started to realize how important time was. So those two concepts of understanding time and understanding the reversal of taking your body away from your extremities and that reversal, or not having an origin and insertion, but just having muscles, those two things really, really influenced my later professional life. That was a long answer, and I apologize for that.
Well, and Jennifer, what's so cool about, you know, the starting point, if you will, and your trip to England and your early your travels and sailing early on is, you know, today you can have these quote PRI discussions or integrative, you know, thinking and all the concepts that you guys will get into later that you now are working on, really you found them a long time before you even found us as an institute, or even maybe possibly people that thought similarly, or, you know, with the same mindset of all of these, you know, gravitational forces and movement and timing, as you described, and how important all of that is now in your clinical setting today, which we'll get into. What I quickly want to ask you and highlight is, once you, first of all, the comment, I don't think, you know, you may think any layman with a head on his shoulders could do that trip, but I don't know if I myself could get in a boat and do that, which is just one of so many reasons why you are who you are today, and we love you so much. But once you came back to the States and found ground again and had all of those kind of aha moments, you know, while sailing, where did you end up practicing, or where was your first kind of grounded roots as a physical therapist? And how did you start, you know, looking at people with those things in mind early on in your career, as you, you know, as you mentioned, using your arm to be really as a ground on the water, or grounding yourself to that boat, or any of the other timing, synchrony, any of the things that you were already thinking about and looking at from an early physical therapy standpoint in your career? How did you use some of those things within your quote clinical setting, or what did that look like when you got back to the States and started practicing?
It kind of took a long time to figure that out. I ended up coming back to, actually I arrived in North Carolina, and I had to do a whole bunch of different types of jobs at that point. In where I am in Eastern North Carolina, in Oriental, it's a town of 900 people. So you can't specialize. You don't have enough people to specialize. You have to do everything. I ended up, you know, showing up here. And as a physical therapist, I ended up, at first I had the school contract, I had the nursing home contract, I had home health. And then there was a little exercise gym, and one room off the exercise gym ended up becoming a physical therapy clinic. And so it evolved, you know. But what I was noticing is that I was using the same concepts for all of these people. You know, the pediatrics or the school children were almost the same as my orthopedic ones that I was seeing in the gym and my geriatric patients. So it was interesting that I started to use the exact same concepts. So what I realized is those things I had learned were very universal. Everyone was breathing. Everyone was, you know, doing all those same things. But it didn't hit me until after I had been in the United States for a while. I ended up going, I'm kind of jumping around here because there's a big segment that I'm missing here, because when I first came back, I didn't put it all together well, is what I want to kind of say here. But what I want to get to is that I then left the United States again. And when I left that time, I sailed across the Pacific and ended up in Samoa. And it was in Samoa that everything sort of came together, because I ended up, it's a very long story, but I ended up being the PT for the Samoan Olympic team, which was one super heavyweight lifter. And I went in there thinking I knew what to do and thinking that, you know, my practice and everything I had pulled together was going to prepare me for that. And he was using pressure for everything. He was lifting with pressure. And I just was like, no, you don't hold your breath. After being, you know, respiratory therapist, you don't do this. And he really made me understand how you can use pressure, how you should use pressure, how you shouldn't use pressure. And I learned a lot at that point. And one of the things he did that really helped me, but ended up hurting him, because he would have medaled, but he ended up coming in 16th that year in the 2000 Olympics, because he had pulled a triceps. And the thing that I used to help him was his left hamstring and his left heel. I could see that he was not getting his left heel down as well as his right. And it was very subtle. And that is what, when I came back after that trip, several years later, after that trip, when I heard about PRI, it was like this clarifying moment that I realized what I had done by accident and how I had found somebody in some institute that started to understand it. And that was a really amazing moment for me. And it was right around that time, after having spent 4 years on that Pacific trip, sailing and being in Samoa, I realized I had never traveled more than about 4 miles an hour on a boat. You travel very, very slow. There was no car in Samoa that I used. So when I got back to the United States the second time is when it actually came together, answering your question. I did not ever want to get in a car because it was like white knuckles. My hands would freak, I'd freak out because going 60 miles an hour was scary. I just saw everything moving by me way too fast. So I got a bike and I started riding. And then I started to get into fitting people on bikes because I was into cycling then. And again, those patterns came and hit me in the face. I noticed that the right foot always needed to be at needly post. On the handle, if I wrapped the handlebars such that I could get them to push their hand into more supination on the left, I could actually get their shoulders to stop, their hands to stop going numb. I was noticing these things. So I was looking at bike fitting articles, and this is where I came across Lori Thompson had written an article about bike fitting and the patterns that she saw for in a bike fitting magazine. I grabbed that article and I read it several times. And I was like, I've got to meet this woman. I just got to meet this woman. So I tracked her down and found out that she taught courses at this place called PRI. So I think I called the Institute at that time. And they said that she was going to be teaching a course in Maryland in like 3 weeks, but that they recommended I first took a course called Myokinematics. So at that point, I think they had them on CDs. So I said, okay, send me the CDs for Myokin and I'll do that first. So I did Myokin one weekend. And then the next weekend I drove to Maryland and did Lori. And I just was so excited and so blown away. And I realized I knew nothing. I had seen the tip of an iceberg and recognized it, but this was the justification and the confidence that I had seen something that other people were seeing. And that was really the first time I noticed that. And that was a huge moment for me. And so I dove into PRI. As you commented, I think I took 12 courses within the first 2 years. And during that time is when one of my very best friends came to me and she had a frozen shoulder. I did not know at the time that 8% of people with Parkinson's who are later diagnosed with Parkinson's, 8% of them first present as a frozen shoulder. I didn't know that, but I started treating her frozen shoulder and I realized there was some neurological symptoms. And I suspected after reading it up on it that it was Parkinson's. So this friend of mine is a investigative reporter on an international level. And I knew that she was going to grill me with questions. She was going to make me have to know as much as I could know about this to be able to explain it to her. If I was to start to tell her, I think you need to go see a neurologist, she was going to grill me. So I started reading as much as I could. And that was a huge eureka moment for me because what I realized in what I was learning about Parkinson's, it meshed perfectly with PRI. I started, I went ahead and I got at that time LSBT, and it still is one of the biggest Parkinson's, credentialing programs. So I got certified in LSBT and then I got certified in Power. Then I got my Rocksteady Boxing certification. I went to the World Parkinson's Congress and I still found that all of those programs, I could find out the common practice in all of those or the common elements in all of those were all based on what I was understanding of PRI. And that was a huge moment for me. And it's what made me start to realize that Parkinson's is not a specific disease. To me, Parkinson's is a syndrome that almost all of us are showing signs of at different levels, at different degrees, but we're all showing signs of it. And I started to look back into why that's happening. And these are the things that luckily Ron was really understanding when I asked him some questions about it. And he latched on to that. And so the two of us started to realize why Parkinson's and PRI are such a match. It's not because that disease matches matches PRI. It's because Parkinson's reflects the timing issues that are happening in our brain as far as how they receive the lateralized signals from both sides of our body. It's the part of our brain, the basal ganglia, that monitors and modifies those signals is what's affected in Parkinson's. And that's the same thing that is affected in anyone who shows any of the PRI patterns, which is everybody. That was a long answer.
You know, you talk about really all of the things we're going to discuss more here in a minute with Ron, but really what's so cool, Jennifer, that from my point of view and anyone that gets to know you and I'm still doing so today, is that you really basically a lot of people that are discovering PRI or introduced to PRI or find PRI, some of it is organic and they do find it on their own by searching and similar to you, you know, you were interested in bike fitting and you found a bike fitting article, but so much of what you were seeing already through your travels, through your work with individuals, through your clinical, you know, application with friends or whoever it may be, so much of what you were already seeing and realizing was really part of the patterns we look at as an institute before you even found the institute. So for you, it's so cool because you came to this science already appreciating those things, whereas some people find the science and are just starting to appreciate those things or just hearing about those things or just thinking or learning or exposing themselves to those concepts. So it's really cool. And I don't know many people like you in the PRI community that really found the science as coinciding with how your mind and how you were already perceiving the patients and clients around you. And what a gift, as you said, to finally find this institute or a science or a person or several people to really solidify that, you know, what you were seeing is being seen across the board or is being looked at by other people. So I wanted to just capitalize on, you know, how that moment must have felt to you taking that first course or being exposed to Lori. And as you said, you dove in deep and fast and you quickly went through the coursework and ingrained yourself with our science and those individuals and instructors that teach it. One thing I do want to just briefly talk about, Jennifer, before we pull in Ron and get into, you know, more of this basal ganglia discussion and how it fits into your current treatment of those who are diagnosed with Parkinson's disease and how that relates to, as you said, everyone with PRI patterning that is starting to display sightedness or dominance or lateralized function on a daily basis. You know, obviously since you found the science and you found like-minded individuals that were teaching it and instructing it, it's a natural thing that you eventually became credentialed and went through the credentialing process to kind of further your involvement and your proximity to this institute. But was there anything, you know, I bring this up with all of our guests just because for us, that's one of the most powerful times of year as far as bringing more providers in, welcoming them to our network and our providers and everything that comes along with credentialing. But is there anything that you want to highlight or mention, you know, at what point did you finally see yourself ready, or what made you actually want to go through that credentialing process? Anything that stuck out about it? Again, for us and myself, you were credentialed and went through PRC testing in 2015, shortly before I was kind of here full time. And I mentioned that to you, that I was really excited to get to know you more today, because oftentimes we use that credentialing process to really have one-on-one time and get to know people. Had you had much, you know, contact or discussion with Ron like you do today at that time, or kind of just walk us through what the credentialing process was for you, how it helped guide you through your PRI journey and really become more involved and find those other, you know, clinicians, mentors, colleagues that you communicate today with on a daily level. So any thoughts you have about kind of that journey for you?
It was the people that made me want to join the community of PRI, in the sense that they were, like you're saying, there were some of the, you know, we all like-minded people. I like people that have very different views, and I like people that have, you know, the like-mindedness. And it was really nice to have discussions. And one of the early people, because I live so far out, I had to go to the Institute and go to these courses and seek them out to meet people. And that was where I had some of the best conversations and met some of the people that I connected to the best. And so I wanted to go to Lincoln. I wanted to go and meet, you know, and be with these people as much as I could. And it was that mingling and those times that meant the most to me. The course material was fantastic, and, you know, but it was meeting people that I could bounce ideas off of, I could get ideas from, I could talk to. And since, you know, the closest PRI therapist, I'm very fortunate, that is in Chapel Hill. And there's an incredible group, as you all know, Susan Henning, Lisa Mangino, and Jean Massey, and now quite a few others. But they're about 3.5 hours from me. So I would drive out there. And if I had a patient that I knew was applicable, you know, would do well, I actually drove patients out. I think we rented a van one time, and I took 3 patients out to see Susan Henning in one day. And I got to sit in, and I did it for selfish reasons. I got to watch Susan treat 3 different people. And it was great to get that, like you're saying, that like-mindedness. And I'm very, very happy that I had the Institute to be able to introduce me to those people. But like I said, it also gave me confidence in what I was doing. And that confidence is why I'm actually even talking to you today, and why I'm agreeing to do the symposium, is because I've had my theories for, like you're saying, a long time, but I have always stayed under the radar. I like to stay quiet. I don't have any social media presence. I deliberately kind of keep myself under, because I don't have the confidence that what I do is right. I like to work with my patients. I have a really great, I was going to say a loyal patient following, and I feel I'm fairly well regarded around here, but I didn't feel like my ideas were ready to be hatched. And it's a little tiny story, but I'll tell you, when I was in Samoa, there was the waiting room. This hospital is not your normal hospital. It was like my first week or two there. I walked out into the waiting room to get a patient, and there was a chicken sitting in the corner of the waiting room. And I didn't think anything of it, because we'd had chickens coming in and out of there before. So I went back, but every time I came to get a patient that day, there was a chicken, that same chicken sitting in the corner. So finally, at the end of the day, I picked the chicken up to put it outside, and I realized she'd been roosting on a little egg-shaped mango. And I thought, oh man, all day she's been, you know, she was so hopeful sitting on that mango and nothing's going to come of it. And that's kind of how I felt about my ideas. And when I met PRI, I finally felt that I was sitting on something that has the potential to hatch into something very big. And that was kind of a silly story, but it gave me hope and a real positive feeling that I was heading in the right direction now, that I wasn't just sitting there hopeful and hoping and expecting this to do something that it never was going to do. I felt like I finally was a part of hatching something big. Does that make any sense at all?
It's a great story. And really, we're so thankful that you're at the point you are and willing to share your story and everything we've discussed, and even more so through this spring symposium coming up. Again, I don't know anyone like you. I know Ron would say the same thing, and that's you, because that's who we all are. We all are on a different journey, a different path. You know, how cool for you to be, you know, I don't even know what the right way to say it, Jennifer, is, but to be okay with your own skin and where you're at, your community, and helping people really on an individual one-on-one level is really at the heart of what I think all PRI clinicians strive to be. You know, if you can't really change one life, one patient, one client, and really connect with that one individual on a daily basis at a one-on-one level, you can't really get to that point of hatching something greater. So I think it's why you are who you are. And it's really why, you know, we're so excited about your involvement and sharing what you do with the rest of PRI and the rest of our community. We're going to pull Ron in here in a minute. Before we do that, I want to just briefly have you give the listeners a quick, you know, segue to our discussion about the symposium and what you guys have been working on. If you could just kind of walk us through your setting today, presently, for anyone that hasn't caught on so far in this dialogue, you work a lot with, you know, individuals who are on some form of a spectrum of movement disease or disorders, or basal ganglia diseases, extrapyramidal disorders, Parkinson's disease being one of them. Walk us through, before we get into some of the upcoming material, how you really became known for that community, you know, some of the classes you offer, your typical clientele, as I said, and how you got to that point where people are now seeking you out as, you know, a well-known clinician in your area for working with these patients. But just walk us through, not necessarily, we'll get into probably later on some of the implementation and the activities you do with these individuals, but how you got to that point, who a lot of your main clientele is in today's clinical setting, some of the other, you mentioned a lot of the other trainings and pieces you pull in, including rock steady boxing, including a lot of Parkinson's training and different groups that you pull in and work with. You mentioned a lot of your bike fitting activity, and I know you're still an active cyclist and still do a lot with cycling. But just quickly talk about, you know, some of those avenues other than PRI that you use clinically, and who some of, you know, primarily the large portion of your population you work with, and how you got to this point.
All right. The way I got into Parkinson's was basically through that friend of mine. That's how it all started. She was in her, you know, early 50s and showing the signs. And like I said, I needed to learn a lot about it. So I did go through and get some of the certifications and read as much as I could. And at that time, the very first article I read was by a neurologist out of the Cleveland Clinic named Jay Alberts. And he had discovered, purely by accident also, that he had a person with Parkinson's who was riding her own bike, and he was riding a tandem. And actually, she was riding a tandem with her husband, and he ended up getting her on the tandem with him, because a husband and wife should never ride a tandem together. So she ended up riding on this long trip across Iowa on the back of Jay Alberts' tandem, and her husband was on his single bike now. So anyway, they went across Iowa, and he discovered that when she was on the back of the bike at the end of every day, he was noticing, and she was noticing, all kinds of her non-motor and motor symptoms were changing. So it got him to do some research, and he ended up studying if people on with Parkinson's got on the back of a tandem and were forced to ride, and he used the cadence between 70 and 90, but predominantly between 80 and 90 revolutions per minute, their symptoms changed. And he actually did some functional MRI studies and found that they ended up with the increased dopamine uptake. So they had a release of dopamine, you know, from being on the tandem, and it was almost equivalent to getting a dose of carbidopa. So he wrote this paper, and I saw that, and it was written right around that 2015. And I thought, well, that's an easy thing to do. I could get a tandem and take my friend out on the bike. So I bought a tandem, and my friend and I started riding all over. And we decided, I said to her that if she wanted to go to the Parkinson's World Conference, which was out in Portland, Oregon at the time, it was coming up in a year, that if we got really good, we would take the tandem out there and we would ride. We would go to Glacier National Park and then ride from there, take the tandem over to Portland, Oregon. So she and I did that. And we ended up taking that tandem on a long haul. And she did so much better with it. And that we went to the World Parkinson's Congress. We talked to other people who got into tandem cycling. And it was a big thing right now, right then. So when I came back, all these other people were trying to get in touch with me about getting on the bikes. And long story short is we ended up with four tandem bikes, and I had recruited the cycling community. So all the captains from the cycling community started to ride on the front, and all the people with Parkinson's rode on the back, and we got stationary stands for the bikes. And the local NPR station heard about it, and they ended up doing a profile. So more people started coming. Then I realized that I'm kind of being pulled into being the authority on Parkinson's. So then at that time, Rock City Boxing had just started. So we had, and this was just by chance, a boxer. He's actually, you can look him up, Don Turner. He's in the Boxing Hall of Fame. He set up a boxing camp for professional boxers here in Pamlico County. This county of 900, or this county has 11,000, but the town has 900. Don Turner was a well-known guy here. He's a boxing coach. He had been Evander Holyfield's coach. He had been, he worked with a whole bunch. So I ended up contacting him with this patient, this friend of mine. And we said, we've heard this boxing is good. Would you be willing to have us come out and show us some things? By then I'd already been taking some PRI courses. I told, as I told you. So we went to the most grungy gym you could imagine. It's where he had his boxers, and he had never treated a woman before. He had never heard of Parkinson's before, except for Muhammad Ali. And he had never worked with Parkinson's. And he started working with her as if she was a regular boxer. And I was just fascinated. And so every once in a while, I would see something and I would incorporate a PRI move into it. And he just turned to me and he goes, "Who taught you that?" And I just said, "A farmer out in Nebraska." He goes, "I want to meet that farmer." And so we just had a standing joke about this farmer out in Nebraska. And he was really, really impressed with the PRI stuff. And that got me intrigued, that there's something to this. So, and what I really picked up on was that Don Turner, the reason Don Turner has had 23 world champion boxers is that man could see movement. He has an incredible eye. And even today, not so much the last year, because he does have some health issues, but up until a year ago, Evander Holyfield, who I got to meet through Don Turner, but anyway, they would bring out boxers that they think were going to be really good because they wanted Don to watch them move. And if Don gave them the blessing that they were good boxers, they would spend their time and energy training these guys. But if Don said, doesn't have it, that he wouldn't bother. And so Don, understanding and liking the moves that I was teaching people, was like such a pat on the back for PRI. And I thought it was pretty cool that he was really into that. But then Don couldn't spend time with us. He had a few other things to do. So I ended up going out to Indianapolis and getting trained in rock steady boxing. And then I started classes in Oriental. And I still to this day teach two classes a week of rock steady boxing for people with Parkinson's and or Parkinson's plus type basal ganglia disorders. And I teach those two classes. And because of between the tandem cycling and the boxing classes, I started to get more and more clients coming in. So now I probably see it still is only about 20% of my clientele in the clinic, but it's Parkinson's patients are probably about 20%, but I'm not exaggerating when I say I treat every single one of my patients as though I'm preventing them from getting Parkinson's. And that's where, if I see somebody who has any sleep behavior disorders or restless leg syndrome or a whole list of other things that we will go through in the symposium, I immediately have the red flag up that they're heading down the path towards Parkinson's. And so I can honestly say only 20% of the patients that I see in the clinic have been diagnosed with Parkinson's, but I think a lot more of them are heading towards it. And those are the ones I'm probably the most proud of working with.
Well, that's really the reason, you know, we're doing this and we're doing this together with you is that you may have 20% of people that are already diagnosed, but what can we be doing, as you know, with your classes and with cycling and boxing and any other resources we can pull in to treat the other 80% as, you know, preventative pre-Parkinson's collaboration to hopefully not then be treating them later on, you know, as part of that 20% who have been diagnosed. Such a cool, you know, I know, and I think at this point is a good time to bring in Ron and we'll get into some of that discussion. So I'm going to grab him here, Jennifer, and really what I'll start with here with him is his trip to Oriental. And you talk about these classes that you still do twice a week. He saw that firsthand, and I think it was so moving for him to see these individuals being active in the way that you have them moving, whether that be cycling through a cycling class or boxing. He came back immediately and hung a boxing bag in the gym and started pretending he was one of those boxers. So we'll grab him and we'll get into, you know, further discussion on what he saw and what excited him about what you were doing in Oriental.
Okay, Jennifer. So
really, I think, again, this was a good point to kind of move our discussion. We just got through, for our listeners, we're now joined by Ron Horeska, who's been working a lot in combination with Jennifer Smart for the upcoming symposium. But we just got through discussing her involvement with kind of building up over time, Jennifer, these Parkinson's patients and people with basal ganglia disorders or, you know, motor dysfunction. We just got done discussing, you know, her involvement with tandem cycling and rock steady boxing. And I really wanted to pull you in and kind of start this discussion with your trip to Oriental and really when you saw firsthand what Jennifer was doing with some of her boxing clientele, with some of her cycling classes. And I just got done telling Jennifer that I think, you know, the day you got back, you hung a boxing bag in our gym across the street. So really just to start off our discussion.
I'm not sure it was the day I got back. It may have been 2 days after I got back. But
to start the discussion, just kind of walk us through what that trip for you meant and what it really showed you as far as her, you know, where she's at clinically and how that kind of led into, you know, further involvement for this topic.
You know, RJ, I always look for, you know, I do this. I always look for people who I can resonate with. And I use that word loosely right now. But when I came back from seeing Jen practice in the clinical setting and in group settings, Jen, I came back with a major push. It was my dopamine. You know, it was a push because not only because of her background and experience, but because of her belief And, you know, Jen's got a belief and you can feel it. The entire community, Jen, everything from the person that, you know, showed me my room that I was going to stay in that night, and to everybody in the coffee shop I met, and anybody in that town knows there's a strong belief in what one particular, you know, person in that community does. And that is welcome and promote everything she can out of everybody she works with that has problems, especially with this diagnosis of Parkinson's. And they all believe in each other, and they believe in each other. And they, you know, that Jennifer is so important because they believe in you. And when they see someone like Jennifer believe in what she's doing on a daily basis, across the board, to every cup of coffee she would drink, to any conversation she would have, that's what I came back with. I don't see that Jennifer every day. You know, I just don't. I know you don't either. And so seeing that and watching it, I've had the opportunity to get to know her in the past with, you know, attendance at classes and social gatherings, but to actually witness it and see it, it really promoted a resolve to move forward with someone who I know I could work and study and discuss and pedagogically think with along the same lines that you do, because you're living it. You're absolutely living it. I can tell you, Jennifer, I don't live it. I study it. I apply it. So do you. But your responsibilities to what you do are directly felt both by you and those individuals that you're working with. And the successes and the non-successes all blend into outcomes that we should all be mindful of when we start talking about this midbrain, this brainstem. And so I got to tell you, RJ, number one is when I came back, you know, I came back fired up. There's so much that we aren't going to be able today to talk about, but I know you've probably touched base on some of those. And that fabric behind of that belief, you can't cover it because you grow up with it. And the way Jen has grown up, the way she looks at the world and the environment and the behavior around her is kind of like what your dad did. You know my background. And so when I see it, Jen, when I see that, and I see that hard knocks of reality, you know, what is real, what's scientific, what's what problems do we have that can be solved and cannot be, and where are we at with the actual application of clinical and I'll say even the word non-clinical, what I would call behavioral experience. You have all that because you're a gift. So yeah, I came back fired up. We put a bag up because I really believe what I saw in that gym of yours was something we all should be mindful of. Reaching, punching, alternation, resonance, flow generated by a body that is trying to figure out where it belongs. And I mean that sincerely. So that was one of the things I came back with.
Well, and, you know, we talked a little bit throughout the prior discussion about, you know, this topic in general and how really it's an embodiment of her and what she's doing. I think, and you can tell me if I'm wrong, you probably first had the topic of this symposium in mind. Well, I know it's been close to 3 or 4 years ago, but as soon as you did have that in mind, I think there was really only one option in your mind of who you wanted to bring in to discuss this topic.
That's very true.
Jennifer, as much as we look for these topics, and he's always, you know, considering oftentimes 3, 4, 5 years previously from the symposium, working on the content and the speakers and the discussions. But as much as this symposium was built around the content, I think in some ways it was built around you because of everything he just said. So why don't you just walk us through a little bit quickly, and then we'll get into some of Jennifer's discussion. But just from your perspective as kind of the organizer of these symposiums, walk us through, you know, the title of this year's symposium, Basal Ganglia Disease, which we're holding on April 23rd, 22nd, 23rd as a live stream and a live course. But walk us through what your conceptual meaning of this symposium is how the basal ganglia will be looked at as a whole. And then we'll get into some of Jennifer's topics.
And dangerous.
Well, and dangerous shortly.
Once I get started on this, Jennifer, you know how this goes. It's hard to not pull away from certain topics. But I will say this. RJ is correct. We look at, I personally look at opportunities in terms of what I believe, what we do, Jennifer, with posture and movement disorders and movement order. I look at them as an opportunity to bring in concepts that we can't really discuss unless we talk about syndromes that we can look at and apply scientific rationale across the board to patients who do not have Tourette's or do not have Parkinson's or do not have issues with tremors. They're normal people out there. They're walking around just fine these days, but underneath of that fineness is an infinite amount of activity that we have to respect because things can genetically come across as genetically or environmentally throw you off into a land where you start to realize that the world's a little different. It's called, control, and it's called, management. And the regulation of what we do with our movement is got to be in an order. It's got to be an order for smooth transition, inhibition, and, excitement. Is a constant battle in lives. And Jennifer, you know that our biggest role as clinicians is to help people manage that excitement, that neurological synaptic excitement. And that's going through two sides of our brain and front and back and up and down. And we know enough to know that there's relationships established with patterns we see in the movement dysfunction that relates to that excitement. So when I look at the word basal ganglia and I think about this this symposium, there was a number of years where I was thinking about when and where would we introduce it. And there was a two, Jennifer and RJ, when we looked at the title years ago, I thought, who's going to want to come and listen to someone talk about Parkinson's or, Tourette's or tremors or any type of disorder where it comes when movement is an issue because of a diagnosis, not an issue.
Not just movement though, attention deficit.
Yeah, well, anybody who sees those words, I was thinking would, and I still believe this to some extent, the attention deficit, the sensory implications that we know that exist, Jennifer. To try to get someone to understand the significance of going to a conference or a course or a seminar to understand those concepts and be able to then extract that information and apply to their worlds where they don't see it, but yet it's there. It's kind of a cumbersome thing to do. And so I thought, well, we'll give it a shot. We had a number of speakers set up before COVID hit that this symposium was going to include. As COVID hit, and it gave us a time, Jennifer, to reflect on, we have so much information here about, I'm going to refer to as movement, whatever that means. And yet I didn't feel like that first round of activity would allow the clinician to go home and apply things conceptually, scientifically, properly, because of the vast amount of information. RJ collected stuff from Parkinson's associations around the world and country. And the material was endless. I mean, there's so much on it. So we honed it in a little bit. We put this word basal ganglia to it. The basal ganglia is, the brain's brain. It's how our brain takes information and uses it for the brain to help it process whatever our body is sensing and wants sense from. And when I look at the overall role of this particular symposium, we narrowed it down a little bit. We narrowed it down into topics that I think are going to help everybody. The role it plays in motor control and this word oscillation, which I'm sure you probably have already talked about, but this need for us to understand that our frequencies of our body is what our brain really understands and maybe doesn't, but that's how we work. We work off of brain waves. That's it. Our brain is complementing what we do and our body complements what it does through oscillatory brainwave function and how we get that information up and down our thalamic system, our nervous system, our central nervous system, depends on how excited we are with our autonomics or not, our somatic activity. So I look at the RJ and I just scan these topics. I think the word practical is in your talk, practical implications. I look at the word pathology and as it relates to this word called trunk, inflection of the trunk. This bent spine, you know, this thing called camp tachycardia, where people are walking in a forward, they can't get there fast enough state. You know, the emphasis is put on forward movement. We all have to have forward movement, but we're going to talk about forward movement as it relates to this particular region of our body's brain. What's going on with the need for our body to react to a brain that's saying, you know, make sure you go forward and you think about this timed event, phasic and non-phasic activity that's got a sequence to it, algorithmically look at it. So there's a lot here, RJ, that I could continue to go on. And I want to just say one more thing. I don't want to forget his name. Neil Hallinan is the other speaker in this symposium. And Neil's going to offer us a way to take that clinical world we're in and apply it in a way that has really been there for eons as humans, and that is this thing called pitch, music, beat, activities that our body really wants on a scale of metronome type work, you know,
rhythmic
activity. So I'm excited about those opportunities and blending all that in with the science and the research behind it in a clinical, practical way.
Well, and we'll hopefully have time to sit down with Neil between now and April, and we'll see if we can get that to happen. Jennifer, as I kind of discussed with you and with Ron, rather than going through all of these descriptions, which we are going to include on the agendas online, so people can go on and read the descriptions of your talks or of Jennifer's talks, of Neil's talks, but I know how much time you guys have put into communicating back and forth the details and the more practical concepts that are included in some of these descriptions. So Jennifer, I just would like to take a few minutes on each of your topics and allow you to kind of give your perspective from what, you know, what are some of the main points that each of those presentations you will be focusing on. We'll get through them here, but I know in some regards you kind of have, well, your first talk on Saturday is practical implication of intervention and management of those who have been diagnosed with Parkinson's. And you have some case studies and you have some other kind of treatment evaluation. You know, your talks after that Saturday presentation will then help guide people. But let's start with that first practical implications, Jennifer, and just any comments you have from the work you both have been doing to introduce these considerations within the population of Parkinson's. And as you mentioned, Ron wasn't here, but he piggybacked it well by really including the fact that many of the attendees at this year's symposium may not necessarily work with primarily Parkinson's disease or movement disorders as you do. But as you mentioned earlier, Jennifer, 80% of the patients you see, you consider pre-Parkinson's or pre-diagnosed disorders or disease, that we all should be thinking the same and helping those people, you know, preventatively from becoming a diagnosed Parkinson's patient. So any comments you have about the work you've been doing for the implication and intervention aspect of that first presentation you'll be giving?
Certainly, thanks. The first talk is going to be a lot of just getting everybody on the same plane as far as understanding what basal ganglia diseases are. And, you know, it'll be a lot of the literature going through what the diseases are. And it's not just Parkinson's. That's the one that everybody thinks of. But there's, you know, the multiple system atrophy, the corticobasal ganglia syndrome, the progressive supranuclear palsy. Those are all Parkinson type diseases. But there's a lot, like Ron has mentioned, the Tourette's is one, attention deficit disorder is one, gambling, obsessive, you know, but restless leg syndrome. I think that's one that, you know, needs to be paid attention to early on, and particularly people that have sleep disorders. You know, so I'm listing a lot of the things that are known basal ganglia issues, and I'm going through what those, you know, symptoms are, what those syndromes, I'm going to call them, are, list those, then talk about what the pre-existing or what some of the prodromal signs of those disorders are, and what some of the current treatments are for those, and why those treatments. And one of the things I think is really interesting is right now, none of the treatments, aside from physical activity, none of the treatments that we have for Parkinson's really treat the core of the disease. They all may improve the symptoms, or they all might make you live longer with the disease, but they don't really treat or cure the disease. The only thing that they think might do that is physical activity, different specific physical activities. And it's interesting because a lot of the doctors that I know who recommend deep brain stimulation or definitely giving out the carbidopa, levodopa, or dopamine equivalent type medications, agonists or whatever, they're doing it so that the patients have an opportunity to get and to move their bodies correctly so that they can start to treat them with the physical activities. So the medication allows you to move. So the movement is what's the treatment, more than the things that people think are the treatments. Yeah. And so if we can move before we get those treatments or before we need those treatments, all the better. But it is interesting. So the first hour is me talking about those existing diseases and treatments. The second hour, I'm going to talk about the evidence-based movement protocols that are out there, the ones that, like I said, some of them I'm certified in, and how I've picked out the common factors in a lot of those and how they correlate with PRI principles, and how I think PRI is at the foundation of why a lot of these work. And so I talk a lot about that sort of marriage between those acceptable, you know, accepted Parkinson's programs or basal ganglia programs and PRI. That's the first day. And then on the second day, I'm going to actually get into the treatment. What I do is treatment, you know, how I pull these things together. And I'll be pulling things from all the different programs, because I did, I forgot to mention in the first interview with you, was that several years ago, I wrote a grant for the National Parkinson's Foundation. And the grant, which I got, was able to present a retreat for Parkinson's, people with Parkinson's. And it was a 2-day retreat where they came out. And what I wanted to do was feature all the different programs. So I had a yoga instructor that taught yoga for Parkinson's. I had a dance for Parkinson's instructor. I had LSVT, I had power and Nordic walking and all these different things. And each one was an hour program. And the people got to go, other people with Parkinson's, got to try the different programs. And it was really interesting. I did it almost for myself because I got to see how they responded to different programs and what some of the commonalities were and what some of the differences were, and pick the things out that worked. So in the classes that I now teach, I've pulled from some of the best and I've plagiarized a lot of things to pull them together. But that third hour, you know, talk I'm going to give is talking about those specifics, what I've pulled out and what I've gleaned from all the things that I've seen and how I pull them together. And then the final and fourth presentation that I'm hopefully going to do is the case studies, where I'm actually going to demonstrate and talk some about, present my patients, present some of the cases I've worked on, both, and as Ron was alluding to, some of the successes and some of my not so great successes, because sometimes once somebody has become very advanced, I have to change the way I deal with them. And there's some issues that I really think are important for other people to learn so that they don't repeat my mistakes. But that's how I'm hoping to present my time at the symposium.
Well, and this really the second discussion or dialogue here with your second day really, I think, is going to be so fun for me personally and all of the attendees, Jennifer, is this geocentricism or lateralized, you know, timing, sleep, weight shifting, all of those things that we talked about on your travels that you physically felt and learned from at an early time in your career, and putting them all in perspective and implementation for that discussion. I don't know if you have any other comments about any of her topics or how then you'll kind of piggyback that and tie it in with Neil, who I, as I said, will hopefully have time to get on and discuss with.
I think the symposium is going to, RJ, offer the attendee a good opportunity, and correct me, Jennifer, if you disagree with this, a good opportunity to see three people look at this movement situation. I can't find a word, Jennifer, that's going to quite fit it. I can give a lot of words that I think reflect it. But we've got three people here that are very mindful of outcome results, because we're all clinicians. Jennifer, your opportunity even to watch and listen to Neil is going to be a wonderful opportunity for you and I. His opportunity to listen to the work that you do and the ongoing amount of activity that we both have in our research and our application of research and our testing and our field designs that we do every day with not just people who have Parkinson's, but people who have this extrapyramidal system challenge. Not that the pyramidal system's a challenging system, but the activity as a result of that activity in that region of the brain can become challenging. I would like to believe that anybody coming to this is going to see three people being honest. This is what works and this is what doesn't. And this is what you would consider doing when it doesn't. And this is what you should do to hopefully prevent it. And that word prevention, I know, is something you and I look at very closely. Neil's been looking at it for years because Neil lives with some of this compulsive disorder, which is what you were reflecting on a little bit. He's been through this. He understands it. And management of how we move and dance in life and sing in life and generate rhythm in life is really what life is all about. And so when we look at these disease-like symptoms, they're just what you said. They're processes that result in activity, whether it's desirable or not. The brain doesn't know that. So how we then make that system cooperate more appropriately with what we want from that individual as a physical therapist or a movement specialist is where I think the course attendee is going to realize, here's some things that we know that whether you are diagnosed because of your symptoms or because of other testing, the end result says, here's what's important for that part of the brain. That part of the brain needs this. And if you can provide it, that brain's activity will probably be modified by itself. And so I think that's the kind of thing that we are going to give as a result of our clinical, our research, our actual application, and our successes spread out over time. We're not like newbies. Jennifer, you and I have been around, and Neil's been around. We've seen a lot of people. I can't even begin to, I was driving to work today thinking about the research articles that I just know you and I have looked at over the last 2 to 3 years, let alone what's happened before that and what's going to happen because of it. Neil's the same way. So, RJ, I look at the anybody who's interested in movement in general and interested in brain function and rhythm and oscillatory and wavelengths and sense. And Jennifer, what words am I missing? This would be an opportunity. It's a once in a lifetime opportunity for us to all to get together in both live stream and in real time and sit here and have this communication about something I really want to make sure we're all appreciating of. And that is input from each other. And that's what they're going to receive. They're going to receive solid clinical input, which is why we kind of narrow down the speaker list to these three clinicians, who I think is going to offer a lot based on their experience.
I think.
Would you agree, Jen? I mean, would you agree with that?
Yeah. No, I think this year's symposium, you know, I've been to a couple of symposiums, and I've also having what we planned to do for last year. I think it needed this year of gestation, and I think we've pulled together a really good, it's much more focused, but in a way it's focused so that it can be broader.
I agree.
If that makes any sense at all.
Yep. And that kind of takes me into my last comment here is really what you both are saying is it's so applicable to, you know, we could sit here and list off a dozen different fields of thought, movement, dance, resonance, singing, boxing, cycling, everything we've discussed about in the last hour, Jennifer. But for anyone really on the fence about it, or as you guys mentioned, you know, when he was planning for it, who are the people that are going to want to hear about these things if they don't work with, quote, Parkinson's disease? Well, really the main point I would like to end with and consider for anyone interested is that, you know, we heard from Jennifer and Ron and anyone who's working with really any PRI patient or patient in general can look at them as pre-Parkinson's because of all those movement dysfunction, neurological issues that they are having and deal with them in a preventative way. I think, you know, this symposium shouldn't be looked at as just a diagnosis and just a disease like all of those patients can be. So the implications and the implementation of the topics we discussed and the speakers coming, the three of you that will be presenting, I think have such a broad, just what you said, Jennifer, a broad reach. And as you mentioned, fine-tuning it and focusing it over the last year, I think has even evolved into a broader spectrum. So I want to thank you for taking the time to let our listeners get to know you better before we got into some of the work you both have been doing. I encourage anyone listening to, you know, visit our website, visit the symposium page. As we've said a couple times now, this has really been 3 or so years, if not more, in the making. And you both have worked on refining it and educating yourselves throughout those 3 years, researching and reevaluating your own clinical experiences, some of those case studies that you're going to bring into your presentation, Jennifer. Really, it's something we've been excited about now on several yearly basis. We had to reschedule it a couple times because of the COVID lives we currently live in. But thanks again, Jennifer. If anyone has questions about this year's symposium, feel free to reach out to myself. Reach out to the Institute. We'd love to answer questions about these topics, discussions, the agenda that we'll be covering. Jennifer, I hope we covered, and I hope our discussion kind of covered what you'll be discussing and who you are as a clinician and as a person and the history you're bringing with you. We're so excited about, and I really would encourage anyone interested to look into it. So thank you again for taking time with us. Both of you are going to, I know, continue to go back to your desks or offices and continue preparing and continue researching probably dozens more cases or discussions before next month. But again, thank you both. And we look forward to April 22nd and 23rd.
Great. Thank you. Thank you very much for all the time today. That's great. Yeah.
Thanks, RJ. Thank you.
If you're interested in learning more about the Postural Restoration Institute, you can visit our website at posturalrestoration.com. You can also email me directly at info@posturalrestoration.com or follow us on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter to see how PRI Nation is currently applying this science. As always, thank you for listening, and I look forward to having you on our next episode.